You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Try it again. Good evening, Pagoda! It's really good to have you here. We're coming into an evening where Pagoda is going to be hosting Home for Good, and they are going to be working with us. You can see them there in their fabulous green tops. And we're thrilled to offer two separate hours in which they're going to be describing their work. They're going to be digging deep. There's a children's area down here, so please feel free. I would like to say whatever age you are to come and play. But we are thrilled to have Ashley John Baptiste with us, who's going to be talking about his book, Looked After, and in conversation with Tania Bright, CEO of the charity Home for Good. I'm going to hand over to them. It's going to be a very relaxed evening, and there'll be space for Q&A later on. The session is being recorded, so just bear that in mind if you've got any questions later. So a huge Pagoda welcome, please.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear us all right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for being here. And I have the incredible privilege of welcoming Ashley John Baptiste. Now, many of you will know him from the television and from radio and many things. He is an acclaimed journalist and broadcaster with the BBC, but he does a lot more as well. And one of the most amazing things that he's done is to offer us the generosity of writing a book called Looked After. It's literally just been published, and we had the privilege of being at the book launch in Piccadilly, Waterstones, wasn't it, in Piccadilly, just a few months ago. And so because of his story, and as I've said, the generosity of him sharing very, very deep and heartfelt stories of his life, we are delighted that he agreed to do an interview tonight for Greenbelt. So, Ashley, you are so welcome. Greenbelt, first time?
First time
first
here.
Time
What's up,
Greenbelters?
Everyone? Oh, I feel so welcome. Thank you.
Unbelievable.
I love how chill it is. The vibe. I love
nice.
The vibe. Yeah, I kind of want to be out there with you. But, yeah, here we are working for my supper.
There you go.
It's good to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. And I'm going to open up, Ashley, because I really just want to go in very, very sharp in one sense with why. Why did you write this book? Because it's hard to read. It must have been harder to write. Why did you write it?
Wow. Well, Tan, thank you so much for doing this with me. Can you guys hear me properly? Good, good, good. So just by way of introduction, I just want to give an outline of my journey. So I grew up in the care system in South London. My mum had me when she was really young. She was 17. She didn't have a lot of agency, and she was a victim of quite severe abuse. And so I was placed into the care system. And between the ages of 2 and 18, I was moved between 4 different foster homes. And I also spent time in a residential care home. So we're talking about 5 moments of deep trauma, 5 moments of what felt like abandonment, what felt like rejection, a journey that many looked after children currently experience. And then at 18, I was given keys to a council flat, and I was told that I was no longer the Blue Males are here. Hello. Oh my God. Sorry, I used to live
Who
with their
they?
Son.
Oh,
I used
hello.
To flat share with their son.
Hello, stand up.
Hello. I will never forget Ben's mum's face. Well, good to see you. How's Ben doing? He's in Jersey now. I'm so sorry. Good to see you. Wow. All right, I'm really going to watch what I say now. Crikey, at 18 years old.
Was that a blast from the past, was it?
Well, I used to live with their son, like, maybe 7 years ago. We lived together we went on holiday in Greece. That was a great trip. Anyway, sorry. Sorry, guys. Rejection, the care system.
You had just got to the point of saying, given keys Hello. To your first flat.
That was a real plot twist. Wow. At 18 years old, I was given keys to a council flat. And I was told that I was no longer the responsibility of the state because I was now a care leaver. And so that's the backdrop to this book, all right? Writing about my journey in care. And to your question, Why did I write this book? Well, I am a BBC broadcaster now. I ended up going to Cambridge University, and I say that to say that I've always been quite forward thinking. I've always tried to, you know, move forward from that trauma. I've always tried to overcome that trauma by building my life in a positive direction. So to write this book, I had to do the opposite. I had to go back. I had to sit in moments of rejection. I had to sit in moments of really deep trauma and pain. And actually, the reason primarily why I chose to do that, why I chose to go back, reflect, write, is because most children do not have agency over their stories. I had social workers writing about my life. I had teachers. You know, when you're in care, you get records. The local authority will compile these records of your time in care. And I got my records. And it felt as if the author of my life were the social workers and the local authority. So part of me choosing to write the book was actually reclaiming my own agency and voice over my own story. Now, I'm fortunate because of my work as a broadcaster, I got offered a publishing deal with a great publisher, but most looked after children, most care experienced people won't get, you know, a great publishing deal. But this was an opportunity for me, hopefully, to shine a light on this system, to, whilst we are not a homogenous group, to represent the journeys and the stories and voices of other looked after children, and to really just kind of, my hope is that the book will educate people. It's not preachy. I'm not overtly critical. I just share my story from the child's voice. I try to go back to what I remembered as a child in certain moments. I talk about the nuances of certain homes and moments of rejection or being let go. There are a lot of themes in the book, but really it's about giving voice, to what it is to be care experienced.
Ashley, thank you. Let's get into some of those themes that you talk about. And in chapter 3, which is called Institutionalized, you talk about being driven away, quite literally driven away from your first foster carer, Joyce. And it was the chapter when I first started crying when I was reading it, Ashley. I'll be really honest with you. It just got me because I could hear the words that Joyce had used with you to create belonging, yet actually what that did was to set up a set of expectations for you around what home was and what you could expect from it. Actually, you write, "I've been brutally torn from my childhood community and no one seemed to care about it. How was this decision, i.e. to be taken from Joyce, meant to be good for me? Could you explain to us, Ashley, how defining that moment was for you, leaving Joyce?"
Yeah, so Joyce was the first foster mum that I can remember. Has anybody seen The Nutty Professor? Joyce was like, you know when Eddie Murphy plays the mum in The Nutty Professor? Joyce was like the mum from The Nutty Professor. Like, you know that scene, for those who've seen it, I hope this cultural reference lands at Greenbelt. I've never been there before. I have no idea what you guys watch. But basically, she was this Caribbean matriarchal woman who was just the sort of center of the community's orbit. Big dinners like Caribbean cuisine, jerk chicken, rice and peas. Does Greenbelt know about planting? Yeah. Oh, wow. Yes.
We're culturally informed.
Yes. Good. Plant it like the whole shebang. And when I talk about Joyce, I talk about food because that's the memory I have of her. And as you said, you know, she used language that created expectation, you know, words, especially when you're a child in your early years, words create bonds. And Joyce's words created a bond with me. I thought that she would be my forever home. I thought I was a part of her family. She was like my mum. I didn't expect that I would move around, but at around the age of 7, Joyce decided that I had to leave her. And it was hard enough having to swallow that pill of I'm leaving my childhood home, but then there was the way that I moved. So I wasn't told where I was going to be moved to. The day that I moved felt like a really normal morning. I was watching children's telly, CBeebies, the Teletubbies, shout out Tinky Winky, Badman Teletubby. And I was having my cereal, and in that moment of normalcy on a spring morning, a car of professionals rocked up to the house. and one of the workers told me it was time to leave. And I remember beginning to weep. I was 7 years old. I was confused. I began to look for Joyce, who was now packing my belongings. And I remember begging her to keep me, telling her that I would be better behaved, I'd be more compliant, I'd be a better kid. And in that moment, I was moved into this car. And I remember being in the back of the car, looking through the rear window at Joyce, who was now stood outside the house. And the car began to drive off, taking me away from her as I was crying and looking at her. And she got smaller and smaller as we drove into the distance. It's really hard for me to articulate the trauma, the pain, the deep sense of abandonment that comes when you are moved from who you perceive to be your mum. And even in the car, I had no idea of where I was being taken to. But I was taken to a residential care home, which, if you know, is nothing like Joyce's house. You've got shift workers. So from 9 to 5, there'll be a bunch of workers supervising me. And there were other boys in the home. There were around 6 other boys. And then they would leave after their shift and another batch of workers would sleep over. And day after day, this would rotate like clockwork. A home of boys with shift workers and a deep sense of apathy, which was worlds apart from what I knew at Joyce's home. And so being at Joyce's and having to leave her, I think it really informed me of how brutal the care system can be. It spoke to me about the fact that it's really hard to form lifelong connections, even currently in the care system. And so from there, when I left Joyce's and I moved between different homes, I began to prepare for rejection. I began to preempt and expect that foster carers and caregivers would let me go. And so there was a real lack of permanency in the relationships, you know, during my time in the care system. And that real revelation of that came from, it started when Joyce let me go. And I think navigating the care system from Joyce's was really hard.
So Ashley, in light of what you've just shared, and given that we know that the care system isn't a product of conscious design, right? It's bolt on after bolt on after bolt on of different parts across 60 years. And given your experience, what is it that we need to see happen in the UK to make sure that what you experience doesn't happen again?
That's a really big question. I mean, you know, Joyce was just the start. So I moved to a residential care home. I was there for a couple of years. And then I moved to another home and then another home. And you can imagine how, I'll come to your to answer that point, but you can imagine how that trauma informed every part of my life. So let's talk about education, for example. Sort of quick broad point, the outcomes of looked after children, even now when it comes to higher education, is spectacularly low compared to the wider population, right? We're talking university, higher education, everything else. And so for a long time at school, I didn't have aspirations. I couldn't function in a mainstream school setting. I didn't trust teachers. How could a kid who has been let go by Joyce be expected to trust the authority of a teacher? So for a long time, I didn't trust teachers. My first expulsion happened at 7, and move after move was mirrored by school after school. So for a long time, I was on this trajectory, this journey of underachievement. I ended up getting good grades. I ended up, you know, going to uni, as I've said. But I think the consequence of the sort of life that I had in the care system, so you've got the transience of foster parents, also you've got the transience of social workers. It becomes very hard for a kid to have self-esteem. It becomes very hard for a kid to have a positive sense of outlook for their future. And so it's a really unfortunate thing to say that I was one of the fortunate ones. And we can potentially go into why my outcome was different to most foster kids. But the fact is, you know, as you say, layer upon layer, but the system kind of sets kids up to fail even now. To your point of what needs to change, well, there's a lot I could say. I could speak for 2 hours about what needs to change. I didn't have permanency in relationships. Now, a couple of years ago, I made a documentary for the BBC about siblings in care, because most sibling groups in the care system will get split up. So you could have a sibling group literally living regions apart across different homes, not having any contact over years. And a lot of the time, sibling groups become estranged. So the reason why I did this documentary, and I'm going to answer your question, this is to your question. I found out in my mid-20s that I had siblings, right? One got in touch via Facebook in my mid-20s. During my time in care, no social worker or professional had told me that I had siblings. So I grew up thinking I was an only child. Then a brother contacts me on Facebook in my mid-20s. And then my daughter was born in 2020 during COVID. A few months after her birth, we went for a checkup. Now, bearing in mind, I knew what my brother looked like because of Facebook. I'm leaving the hospital with my daughter after this checkup. And who walks into the hospital? My brother! And it felt so natural and normal. And there was no big awkwardness. We just had a chat. But that then sparked the question of, how comes I'm only meeting my brother now? How comes I didn't know that I had... I went on to find out that I have four siblings. My dad was a bit of a pest, and that is putting it lightly. Anyway, from that, I did this documentary about sibling relationships in the care system. Now, a sibling, if you can connect a sibling group in care, that is the chance at a lifelong link. I could have had a lifelong link with my brother. That would have meant Christmases, not being as lonely. That would have meant having someone to consistently talk to during the transience of all these other adults in my life. It could have meant having an uncle for my daughter to know growing up, right? So to your point, what could change? Well, for starters, it doesn't cost a lot and it doesn't take a lot to foster lifelong links. Be that sibling groups, be that mentors, be that designated people within local authorities to really support young people through the different seasons of your time in care. So I think fostering lifelong relationships is a really, really critical thing, because most people will leave care not having a permanent relationship. And that makes all the difference. It speaks about love. It speaks about connection. The basic stuff that we need as humans. Following my documentary, there's a charity called Quorum. And they watched my documentary and they emailed me to tell me that they had started a service for sibling reunification. There is no reason why every local authority, you know, couldn't set up a sibling reunification service. We know that there's a shortage of foster carers across England and Wales. And long-term foster carers and adopters. That's something that we need. We need more people to foster. Josh McAllister, an individual who's now an MP, he was commissioned to write a report, an independent review into the care system. And there's a shortfall of like 5 billion quid, like money is needed to go into the care system. And though there are big policy issues and though there's a lot of money that's needed, I think some of the solutions to that I've just said, some of it's just common sense, and it's about joined up, you know, approaches between different sectors within local authorities. And it's about fostering lifelong links. I think that is so critical when it comes to the outcome of a looked after child. Thank you.
Yeah, a round of applause for that.
Having someone to believe in you, you know, I think that's what's important.
And that really is just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? I mean, as you said, you could do a 2-hour seminar just on how would we redesign it. And we acknowledge that, you know, this is about systemic change as much as it is about us each individually playing our part. We need to be looking as to how we can do some re-engineering of this. But maybe that's part two, Ashley. But
The point of needing more foster carers, I think it's great what Home for Good does. I think it's, you know, I know that you work with churches, but I think it's fantastic that, you know, that you are supporting people who may want to become foster parents, or people who might, there might be people here today, you might think, you know, you might be interested in fostering, but you're not sure if you've got what it takes, or you have your own reticence for whatever reason. But I often say that if you feel like you've got it within yourself to commit to a child, to love a child, you know, and be enduring with a young person, you're probably perfectly placed to be a foster carer. And there's so many resources out there to support you and help you make that decision. Some people think they need to be wealthy, or they think they need to have 20 bedrooms in their house. You don't, actually. There are rules depending on the local authority you're based with. But I would say if it's something you're interested in, I would really urge you and encourage you to pursue it.
I mean, talk about segue to my particular bit, which is after this session, Home for Good is running a session to talk about exactly that. So thank you so much, Ashley. That's very, very good of you to share that. Because what Ashley is sharing is just sadly a growing reality. We have never needed more foster carers than ever in the history of social services. It's actually called a national emergency right now. If I was talking to you this time last year, it would have been 36,000 children entering into care for the first time in the next 12 months. Ashley, today it's 38,000 children needing care over these next 12 months. And that number, unless there is something done at a systemic level, or we get a massive influx of new foster carers, we still yet won't be able to meet the needs of children. And what Ashley has gone through will be replicated, and we are trying to do all we can to stop that, to learn from what you went through. So given we are asking the question, who cares? And that is the Home for Good campaign, is literally who cares. And Ashley, you write that in your book. I was just struck where there's a sentence that says, it made me ask the question, who cares? How do you find, even now today, Ashley, people are engaging at a general level with the care crisis? Or do people avoid the topic?
Wow, I don't know. So, you know, I'm really not plugging my book when I say this, but the reason why I wrote the book is it's not a policy book. It's not for, like, I'm really, the response has been spectacular to the book. But for me, I want to give it to my next door neighbor, you know, and I want them to be able to get an insight into the care system in a really human and simple way. And so to your point about, I think most people don't really know, to be fair to them, I think most people don't really know what it is to be a looked after child. They don't know the hardships. They don't know the nuances of rejection and probably stigma. What I will say is that some may have quite a negative view of what it is to be a looked after child. Anytime, you know, you hear of a plan for a residential home to be built in an area, for example, you often find that local residents will challenge the council because they don't want the area to become devalued, because that's the perception of care kids, that they devalue a particular community. And then you think about the biggest villains in the shows or the movies that we watch. Troubled kid, grew up in care, that's why they're a murderer. Or do you know what I mean? We all know those tropes that we see in the media. And then I work in news. I work for BBC News. That's sort of my bread and butter. That's my day job as a senior reporter. And I see the language that's used to describe looked after children. So we know their stigma. But this is what I will say. Care kids are some of the most resilient, vibrant, capable, creative people that you will ever meet. If you're... Yes, yes. Come on. Like, if you're able to navigate the deepest trauma and rejection as a kid, and you're able to level that and get over that, I'm sorry, but that is a lifetime achievement, regardless of what you go on to do. That level of resilience and courage is remarkable. So you know, in terms of what people can do, I would just say get educated. I would say if you know of, you know, a looked after child in your kind of oversight, be it, you know, the church you go to, if you go to church, or maybe your kid's school or whatever, maybe you've got a care experience colleague, take the time to get to know them. And that sounds like a really simple thing. It's not particularly solutions focused, but sometimes just just getting to know people, getting to know your neighbour is kind of the best way, isn't it, to get an insight into an issue. You can read my book, Looked After, and also plug into organisations like Home for Good. But to your point, do people care? I think if we had more insight, if we had more understanding, I think we would care. Anytime I've had the fortune of speaking to an audience, I become overwhelmed with the response of people who now are asking, how can I help? What can I do to make a difference? And so we are all compassionate. We all have the ability to help someone. In terms of sort of more broadly politics or, you know, the government or whatever, I mean, look, let's talk about local authorities. Austerity means that children's services are often the first service in a local authority to be cut. Everyone know, you may know about Birmingham City Council. They've had to cut their children's services by a quarter since going bankrupt. Who gets affected by that? Looked After Children. And so, again, I wouldn't even say it's not that people do not care. I think that the structure of local government and our politics is so stretched and challenged that sometimes it's hard to express that care adequately. Yeah, there's so much I could say about that.
Let's move into the topic of faith and hope,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
One of the reasons Home for Good feels so committed to talking to men and women of faith is because the conversation can land on hope. You see, we may not agree on theology, we may not agree on politics, but actually hope we can all agree on, right? That by and through faith, there's always hope. And in reading your book, Ashley, the thing that hands down, even through huge adversity, hope is what I came away with the most after reading your book.
That's good.
Right?
I'm so chuffed about that.
Can you just talk us through that journey for you of how can we still yet take hope even after hearing all that you went through? Where's hope in all of it?
There were so many good moments in my childhood, by the way. It's really important for me to say that I had some really good foster parents, imperfect, but really good people. And I just want to answer your question, talk about my time in the care home and a care worker. I think this is the best way to answer your question by just talking about my own experiences. So I told you about the care home. You guys still with me?
Yeah.
Good. And in that care home, so this is when I left Joyce's, none of the boys went to school, right? There was just a culture of apathy. There was a culture of, as I said, you had shift workers. Boys would tell their workers, I'm not going to school, can't be bothered. Some had been expelled. And so that culture meant that nobody went to school. When I moved into that home, I had been expelled. So I wasn't going to school at the time. But in the context of the workers, I had what you call a key worker. So he was like my designated worker. His name was Miles. His real name's Lyndon. In the book, I call him Miles. But he wouldn't mind me saying his real name. I'm just going to say Lyndon because I will forget my fake names. And Lyndon, oh, what a G. Lyndon forced me to go to school, guys. And I hated him for it. Caribbean guy, every day, every weekday morning at 7 a.m., he found me a school, a primary school. Ashley, get out of bed. You got clean bucks of shirts? You had a shower? Mister, get out of bed. And I would, in a rage, get out of bed. All right, Ashley, let's go to school. And he would make sure that I was on my way to school and he would take me to school. If he wasn't on shift, do you know what he would do? He'd call up the office and he would make sure that a worker was getting me ready for school. He didn't have to do that. You know, when he wasn't on shift, he wasn't getting paid, whatever. He didn't have to do that. But he was so consistent in that one task, this one commitment to get Ashley every day to go to school. And he was so persistent in this that it became normal for me to go to school. That might sound a bit trivial, but in the context of that home, oh my days. That was miraculous that he had his commitment, his going above and beyond, his sense of service, his sense of duty and care to me meant that now I was going to school. I will always be floored by that. When I left the children's home, I lost complete contact with Lyndon, right? Then a few years ago, I bumped into him on a high street in South London. And he was with his daughter, who's an adult. And I was like, Lyndon, like, shout. And he looked, he's like, who's this? And he's looking around. Fortunately, he recognized me. And I ran up to him, like, it's like the kid in me came out, and I ran up to him, was like, Lyndon! And he was like, yeah, right, Ashley. And there was a real anxiety to that question. And I would go on to find out that he asked that question to other boys, you know, he'd bump into, and it was always really bad news. And I said, Lyndon, I'm good, you know. I went to Cambridge. And he was like, why I went Cambridge for? And I was like, I went to the university. And I told him about my journey as a broadcaster. And at the time, I was an ambassador. This is the second best charity in the care system. I was an ambassador for the Fostering Network. Oh, yeah. Got nothing on Home for Good. And they had invited me to present an award at a ceremony. And the other award was being presented by Kate, the Princess of Wales, then the Duchess. And I was told that I could bring a plus one. And to the animosity of my wife, I invited Lyndon. Now, Lyndon now has skin cancer. He's had it for like a decade. So he's no longer in frontline social care. And we went, I was like, Lyndon, you need a suit. Okay, this ain't the children's home. You need a suit. And bear in mind, I might be a bit busy presenting the award, but I'd love for you to come. And it was this bougie building in central London. We rocked up to the event. He had his Sunday best on. And even the build, I'm going to answer your question, by the way. The building alone was enough to gas him. Look at this building, man. Like everything was a moment for him. And then a producer for the event kind of escorted us in front of the queue. And he's like, why am I taking you to the front of the queue? Like everything was just baffling for him. And then we were told that we would get to meet the princess for 3 minutes before the event. Each guest got to meet the Kate for a few minutes before the event. And so we got summoned to the screen room and we're waiting to meet the Duchess. And I could just feel Lyndon's nervous energy. You could tell this is a big moment for him. And then outside the building, you hear the paparazzi and obviously Kate's rocked up. And then it goes quiet again. So she's obviously got in the building. She gets into our green room or whatever you want to call the room. She goes to each guest and I could just feel Lyndon breathing. He's like, how the hell am I in this situation? And she eventually comes to us. She's like, hello. And she's like, tell me about what you do. Lyndon Motormouth. Well, I used to look after this boy, you know. And it was so rude, so disrespectful. And then she's like, I never used to wash him boxer shorts. And like, bear in mind, I meant to be like presenting an award alongside her. And then he's just chatting. And I'm like, I want a minute. I want at least a minute as well. He's already taken two. And then he goes on to be like, but I'm so proud. Look at him. I can't believe that him here presenting an award with you. Like, terrible accent. I'm so sorry. But as he was talking, I decided I'm not even going to try and get a word in. I want this to be Lyndon's moment. Like, for me, he is the real royalty in this moment. And my mind went back to when I was in this care home called Rosebery Street. When Lyndon forced me to go to school, I don't think he expected that I would one day graduate from Cambridge University. When Lyndon forced me every single day to go to school, so in such an enduring, long-suffering way, I don't think he expected that I would become a BBC broadcaster. I don't think Lyndon did what he did because he thought, he's going to take me to meet the future queen. Like, Lyndon just cared. And so to your question about hope, the best kind of hope I know of is in people like Lyndon who show up daily, who go above and beyond. They're not on telly. We're not singing their praises most of the time. Their name isn't in lights, but they have this grit. They have this daily determination to show up for some of the most vulnerable people. And I was not showing potential when Lyndon was forcing me to have a shower, right? I had a lot of needs-based behavior. I had a lot of trauma. But for whatever reason, Lyndon had this incredible determination to support me. And I always ask people, who can you be a Lyndon to? And I ask that to you today, because on that theme of hope, there is nothing more hopeful and there is nothing more inspiring than being a Lyndon in someone's life and having a Lyndon show up for you on a daily basis.
Can we? Yes, exactly. People do often ask over and over, what does it take to be a foster carer or an adopter? And I don't think I've better heard that explained in the 10, 15 years that I've been working in this field and a foster carer, as was myself and an adoptive mum. And it really is that question, isn't it? How can you be a little bit of a Lyndon? And it really strikes me, Ashley, that there's something we're talking about here around belonging, right? Now, Lyndon was working in a residential home at the end of the day, right? But he somehow knew that there was something that he wanted to deposit in your life that gave you a small sense of belonging, that Lyndon cared enough to sometimes go over and above, right? Belonging. Tell us what belonging means to you, because at Home for Good, we talk about it a lot in terms of how the church can get around the foster families and adoptive families. It's about creating a community of belonging. What does that word mean to you?
Well, Oprah. Do you know what? It's such a big word. And I think, like, maybe a couple of years ago, I would have said, I've got my kids, I've got a beautiful wife, and I now have a family. And 100% that is belonging, right? Like I have a community. Beyond that as well, my tribe, my day-to-day tribe, I have a great sense of belonging. And I feel like I've had to work for that. And I don't know if you should work for belonging. I think that like I've had to work on myself. I've had to deal with my trauma. I've had to learn to not project stuff onto, you know, my beautiful wife who comes from a very different walk of life. Like, I've had to do a lot of work. But actually, so that's a form of belonging, yes. But a lot of my childhood and care was based on me performing to be kept in a home. So, for example, when I left the children's home, there was a foster mum who wanted 2 weeks with me to get a sense of whether she wanted me to live with her long term. So it was like an audition, and I called that chapter is called Audition, I believe. I think it's called Audition because it felt like I was on trial. It felt like an audition. And even, bless him, Lyndon said, Ash, a foster mum wants you. You've got to make this work. So for the 2 weeks that I'm at this potential long-term foster placement, I'm thinking, be as compliant as you can, be as likable as you can, be on your best behavior so that she will take you in for the long haul, because the last thing you want is to be in a children's home. That is not belonging, especially when you're a child. If my acceptance is predicated on that really unhealthy sense of compliance. Like, imagine telling your child, if you have children, like, you're only going to be kept here for as long as you meet my expectations. Now, I appreciate there are some really important issues around safeguarding and duty of care and safety when it comes to a placement, 100%. But as a general rule, no child should ever be made to feel that they're on some sort of trial to be accepted into a home, right? That placement should be unconditional. Now, there should be safeguards and check and whatever, but a child should go into a home believing that they belong. And if it's predicated on your performance, it's a really jilted sense of belonging. And some of the best performers we know have backgrounds of care. And that's not a coincidence. I'm talking Hollywood, I'm talking the pop charts, I'm talking society. Some of the best performers we know, their talent is rooted in having to perform from a place of rejection. And so I would love to have a care system in this country where kids do not feel as if their belonging is based on their behaviour.
Wow. And that all comes down to the quality of community and people around you, right? To
yes.
foster that.
Yes.
And you experience that in some part by being a part of a church. I remember reading that there was a
yes.
sense whereby you had some fam around you.
Yes. So I went to so one of the coldest homes I had, I liked their church. I don't want to name the church because there was a lot of, there were many aspects of it that I didn't like. It was, I sound more like a broadcaster now probably than I did growing up in South London, but I was a foster kid and this church was very middle class and a lot of the sort of, the way the church was dressed, I didn't feel comfortable, but they had a youth service first of all, I had a foster mum tell me I was a mistake once. But then I heard a pastor say, you're not a mistake. God has a plan for your life. And if you go to church, you hear that thing kind of a lot, don't you? You hear a lot about purpose and, you know, intent. And but when I first heard that, my background was completely believing that I was a mistake and that my mum didn't want me and whatever else. And so that just sentence was quite revolutionary for me. Theology aside, belief aside, just to know that I'm not a mistake was quite a groundbreaking idea. And then when I moved home, I had to move church because I couldn't stay in the church with the foster mum who let me go. But the second church I went to was like a black Pentecostal church and I loved it. The music was the real draw for me. And there were aunties and there were uncles and you know, you hear this, it takes a village, and that became my village. Just this really rich, abundant community in South London. You didn't have to believe to belong. And I just felt completely accepted. And there was like the auntie who would give you a £10 note. And there was like the guys who would like invite you for a kickabout. And there was so much to that time. The least appealing thing probably was like doctrine, but it was the community and it was the acceptance and it was just all of that that really drew me to the idea of faith. And it became my family and it's where I developed esteem and it's where I developed aspiration and a sense that maybe I could do something with my life. And I would say if not for that church, I definitely wouldn't be on a platform with a published book as a BBC broadcast. Like none of that would have happened. School didn't give me that. It was my community of faith that gave me that.
Let's never underestimate what it is to be within a community like that, you know. And as you say, it's not about the doctrine, right?
No, and I think it's really important, like, and this goes beyond the point of church, but like you never know as like if you're like, I don't know, you sit in the pews and you just say hello to a young person. You never know the impact of your hello, right? You might just write yourself off. You may not want to be a foster carer, but there might be a foster kid in your church. And, you know, you never know what, like there are guys who invested in me and they will never know the impacts that they had because they appear to be so peripheral, but I can cite so many incredible people who made a difference.
It's lovely just hearing how the tapestries all come together and just hearing your story all the way from foster homes, care, residential care homes through to Cambridge, right? And now in the elite broadcasting world.
Oh, stop it.
I mean,
stop it.
But let me ask you a question around that, though, because you do buck the trends, don't you? You buck the statistics because the stats for kids in care are awful.
Sorry to chime in there. I do buck the trend and it pisses me off that I buck the trend.
Exactly right.
Like,
exactly. It shouldn't be that way.
It shouldn't be that way. And I think I used to take pride, like this kind of prideful, well, I must be extra special because I bucked the trend. Whereas now I think to myself, I am not special. Like we're all special, but you shouldn't have to be special to succeed. You shouldn't be special to flourish. Every looked after person, regardless of their failures and mistakes, should have a shot at living a life that's fulfilling, that lends to their talent, to their aspirations, and where they feel loved. And so this is hard won. Thank you, guys. Now I know what it feels like to be Barack Obama at the Democratic Convention. Thanks for the claps.
We feel so passionately that children in care should actually get the best of education and attention and role models and people that put energy and effort into their lives. But that isn't the way that it is. So the fact that you are sitting here able to articulate yourself so well, incredible book, it's just so inspiring because it does give hope, Ashley. It gives hope to us. It gives hope to other
kids. Does it give you guys hope?
Yes.
Well, that's
totally
cool. Good thing I came.
But let me ask you a question, right? Because you've talked about the relationships that hurt. You've talked about the relationships that helped. If you could add any characters in, who would they be, right?
I said this, Denzel Washington being my dad. That would be cool. Or maybe Rio Ferdinand being my cousin. Like these are the sort of relationships. Do you know what? I would say just permanency. Yeah. I would say permanency. Again, going back to my long-lost brother, there is no reason why I couldn't have had a lifelong relationship with him. There's no reason. He lived in the same borough as me. I have an older sister. She's like in her early 50s. She was an adult when I was obviously a kid, and I know she wanted a relationship with me, having met her. So social services, if the right infrastructure was in place, if the right priority was put on that sort of contact, then I would be talking to you and I would be able to talk about my brother like he was actually my brother. And so I would just say, and then even the likes of Lyndon and other people in my life, just we need more permanency in the care system. We need, you know, most kids in care, and that's a conjecture, but I'm pretty confident in it. Most kids in care will probably anticipate just really short-term relationships. And it lends to their trust in later life. It lends to, you know, how they engage with their partners, their view on family. And if you just give a child the opportunity to have permanency, it could literally change their life outcome.
So in terms of today, Home for Good's running the Who Cares campaign, asking the question, who cares? We want to speak to the hearts, but also to the intellectual minds as well of people here, right? Fostering and adoption and caring for teenagers, you know, it shouldn't just be a one-off heart moment because it takes real energy and effort and applied dedication. Now, we've learned a huge amount about what you have shared with us about what could change for the better. But how would you like to encourage the people in this room to think about potentially caring for children or at least being part of a village to care for children? How would you like to inspire us to care?
A few things I've touched on might seem quite trivial, but I think they're really significant. So when I say being informed, I don't mean go and, you know, read a whole load of essays and books and literature. Like, I think just like having a general awareness of some of the issues that looked after children and care experience people face is really important. Again, young people in your oversight, be it at church, be it at school, maybe you're a teacher, be it in your local community, maybe you're a volunteer of some sort, just being a positive voice and presence in someone's life. Mentorship. Oh my God. We need mentors. We need foster carers, but we need mentors. Maybe you've got a particular skill set or you work in a particular, you know, career where you can actually help a kid in a local authority gain a skill or develop their interest. Mentor. That is such a great thing to do. Mentoring, becoming aware, not treating care experienced people based on stigma. So if you have negative, you know, preconceptions about what it is to be a looked after child, you can challenge those, you can change those, you can cultivate a more positive mindset about certain young people. I'd encourage you to do that. And if you want to foster, I would say 100% go for it. I think they're four good points. Are those good takeaways? Can I say one thing? I'm going to say this because 8:30, I'm doing a book signing, but I want you to stay for the second session. I really do want you to stay because this is bigger than us. It's bigger than you or me. It's about the issue. So I'm going to be signing my book at 8:30, okay? I'd love to meet as many of you as possible. If you want a book, there is no pressure. I'd love to hear your stories too. If you want to stay, I will hang around so you don't have to feel like you've got to leave this one early. Is that cool? All right,
that's very
cool. Thank you.
Bless you. So we're coming into land, but Ali, I want to do have...
Are we asking people questions?
Yeah, I want about 10 minutes for questions
good,
and
good,
answers.
Good.
But before we do that, is there anything I've not asked you that you would like to say that's on your heart?
Do you know what? I've said so much in this bloody book. Do you know what's been amazing? The we call it PR. The PR for the book has been amazing. So, you know, I've been just so flattered and floored by the invitations I've got to speak at things. But I would just say, read this book. Like, this is the sum total of what I would want to say in this season in my life about the issue. This was 2 years of work. 2 years of work. And one thing I will say that I've not said before is that, you know, I've been banging on about Joyce, my foster mum. Yeah? She died 2 weeks ago. She died. I know. Oh, she leaned in. but let me tell you why I'm saying that. Because, and this isn't me having therapy on this stage, but her daughters didn't tell me. And I'm not mad at them, but grief is communal, isn't it? We grieve in community. We grieve in our families. We grieve in our religious spaces of worship. And there was no one from my time at Joyce's who invited me to the funeral. And so I remember saying to my wife, where do I place my grief? And it's like there are so many facets of being care experienced that I've spoken or thought about, but I've never had to think about the grief of losing the person you lived with when you were 4 years old, but you've lost contact with them. How do you grieve? Like, she was my mum when I was 4 to 7 to 8 years old, right? But they've all moved on. I've moved on in sorts. But now that she's passed, my mind goes back to being 4, 5, 6 years old. But there is nowhere to place that grief. And the question it sparked, which is a question I'm asking, and I don't really have an answer to, is how do we create spaces for care experienced people to grieve their care experience? I mean, that's a big question, isn't it?
Big question.
Anyway, I'm being really random with that one, but maybe I won't write a book on it, but maybe there's something to do about it.
I think there's something
we could
do.
Because there will be so many care experienced people who don't feel a legitimate right to mourn someone they've lived with because they've been let go, you know? If you're care experienced here, I'd love to meet you, by the way. I really would. I'm not just saying that.
Well, let's go to Q&A. Well, bless you. That's a really profound thing that you've raised there. Q&A. Now, we can't see particularly well because of the lights, but we have our able venue host. Please raise your hand if you have a question for Ashley. I know there'll be many.
And tell me your name and a bit about yourself within reason, please.
And we're going to get the mic to you ASAP. Are you going to run?
And as we come round to you, I just wanted to tell you that Susie and Sheridan from our welfare team are here. So we've had a really courageous day. Tonight's been no exception, but just to say that they are there, they're waving. So if you need to catch them afterwards, use your time as you feel best.
I was just about to say, we're in no rush.
In a sense,
you're in no rush.
You've got a 2 hour session. So if you need to roll over, I'll be led by you.
That's a brilliant idea.
Hi, Ashley.
Hello, what's your name, lovely?
My name's Gail, and I'm coming at this from the opposite side of you. I'm a social worker. So I did 7 years child protection, 13 in fostering, and I'm just next week going into adoption.
Wow.
So from my perspective, I've worked with a lot of care experienced people. Who have experienced a tremendous amount of trauma. And the reason I've been a social worker for 20 years, it's not just a job, it's a vocation. But at the end of the day, I go home, you know, and I leave you with foster carers or in that residential home. So from your perspective, if I was your social worker, what would be the most important thing that you would want me to know about you? And what would be the most important thing that I could help you with?
So I want to touch on my social work when I was thinking about Cambridge University, and that was a great question. So I went on a summer school during my A-levels at Cambridge, and that sparked the aspiration to apply. But I said, I need to go to an open day at a particular college to get a sense of whether I actually want to apply. It was on a Saturday, and my foster parents didn't want to take me. And I had a social worker, and she didn't work on Saturdays. And I expected that she wouldn't take me, because she was banging on about 18, you're going to leave care, you've got to pay utilities, you've got to be able to live independently. But she very surprisingly took me to that open day. When she did that, when she decided to take her day off to take me to the open day, she went from being a social worker, a professional, to being an auntie. The role she played in my life shifted very quickly. And there was a level of respect and trust, because she was being generous. She was using her time off to genuinely care for me and help me and support my aspiration. And I think sometimes it's just those acts that make the difference. Those acts make the difference between you being a professional. As you probably know firsthand, it's those acts that make a difference and takes you from being the social worker who is one of many to being the one who made the difference. And so you are limited in how you can help. You have a broad roster of young people. You are only human. And through my work as a journalist and the range of stories I've told on the care system, I have so many new insights into what it is to be a social worker. I host the Social Worker of the Year Awards. Well, I have done for the last few years, and I hear incredible stories at that event of social workers around England who are doing incredible things. But I would say it's those acts. It's those above and beyond acts, like with Lyndon, like with this social worker, where they've just said, I'm going to help this kid with that, where they just change, you know, and they begin to, you begin to trust them and you begin to see them in a new light. And I'm sure you've done that for so many young people. End answer.
Okay, I'm here at the back. Hello. Firstly,
what's your name?
Georgie.
Hiya.
Hiya. Firstly, I want to thank you for spreading your story as a looked after child. I don't think, even at the ripe age of 33, I've ever heard anyone talk so openly about it. So thank you for doing that. My main question is, how do you think, as a looked after child, we could openly talk about our story and teach younger people that actually life is okay post
that? Are you
that.
Care experienced?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, bless you. Did you say your name's Georgie?
Yes, it is.
Lovely to meet you.
And you.
Where did you grow up?
So predominantly in Essex.
Without giving your details away.
So no, predominantly in Essex, but as I said, like, never had I met someone who was care experienced. So, you know, coming out the other side and being fortunate. You know, how do we, having been care experienced, teach younger generations, you know, younger children, that actually life gets better and it's okay?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I really like that, Tan, that you were saying that, as well as all the trauma that my book sort of flags up, that there's also a deep sense of hope, because there was so much hope in my time in care. And to your point, Georgie, it really is about showing the positive sides of it as well. And when I had my proper book launch event, the amount of positive energy that was in the room, because I told all the care experience people to stand up, and you had like lawyers and you had a rapper and you had like incredible like business owners and just the like, pardon? Say that again. Come on. Shouts for Georgie, guys. but I do think that, you know, again, like, by me speaking up in the way that I can, by you shining your light in the way that you can, we eradicate stigma and we inform and we kind of, without sounding corny, we reveal the truth about what it is to be care experienced. And it goes back to my point that we are some of the most resilient, capable, tenacious people because of what our adversity has brokered in us. And so I would say to you, just do it as loud and as proud as you can. If there are charities like Home for Good that you can tap into, 100%. But it sounds like you're smashing it. And I'm just really flattered that you feel like a little bit kind of encouraged by my being here. So thank you.
Well done, Georgie.
Can we go to the man with the dreadlocks, please? After you. No, after you, we'll go to the man with the dreadlocks. Is that all right? He's been so patient.
Hi, I'm Sarah. Hi, and my context is a couple of things. I've been a foster parent. I've got biological children. I've got foster children. But also my current day job is a budget holder for a local authority. And I don't have a lot of it, is the short answer. And I am adult social care. And my colleagues and I have seen firsthand that throwing over the line of people when they're 18 and we receive wow. them and go, how are we going to help you? And so our local authority have just restructured as much as we can. And we're now going to get them much earlier. So my team will have kind of real decision-making power from 14 onwards.
Oh, wow.
So my question is, what would you want myself and my colleagues to know about people in care from 14 onwards? How can we help them with that transition into adulthood?
Woo! Too big. Wow. I mean, this is a Saturday evening. I feel like I should have come with my Monday morning attitude. It's been a long week, you know, so go easy on me. I would say, I'm going to touch on 25 first, because you may have heard of the term care cliff. When you hit 18, resources stop, as you know firsthand. But then there's also the 25 care cliff, which is some local authorities now acknowledge that there's some provision that can be offered up until you're 25. Maybe you're in higher education and you're staying put in a foster placement, or be it accommodation or whatever. I would say that, first of all, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an expert, but I know that the brain is, when you're 25, your brain is still developing, right? If you've grown up in care, you're dealing with trauma when you're 25, 32, 40s, whatever. The idea that provision stops when you're 25 blows my mind. Because you might, as a bloke, especially with, you know, toxic masculinity, as we call it, you might only admit to yourself that you need therapy in your 30s or 40s or older. You might only discover your brother, like me, in your mid-20s. And so you're still grappling with the aftermath of a life in care well into your adult life. But the provision, the support from the local authority, if you are lucky, if you're in a good local authority, will stop at 25. That isn't serving anyone, number one. So I would say, as much consistency and lifelong, I think there's a big theme here, lifelong support, be it in relationships, be it in the offering that we can give someone. There's a big debate around whether being care experience should be a protected characteristic, so that when you're older, you're able to tap into more resources. So I'd say that support should be continual for a range of reasons that I've lightly touched on. I'd also say that at 15 years old, I was being told, get ready for 18. Because at 18, you're going to move into a council flat. At 18, you're going to have to pay utilities. You're going to have to cook. So in the last few years of my life in care, despite being in a foster home, I had to cook my own food. So my foster mum would cook for her family, then I would cook my own meals after they all had dinner. Because the aim of that was for me to be able to know how to cook when I moved into my council flat. Is that clear? What does that do to me though when my family are eating but I can't eat with them and I'm having to cook by myself and I only get a grace period during Christmas or whatever? So from the age of 14, I'm thinking I need to know how to cook. I need to know how to pay utilities. I need to know how to live. I need to survive at 18. So my aspirations are low on the priority list. My thoughts about higher education are not dominant. I don't give a rip about my GCSEs, most likely. And so how can we really get a kid in care to take their attainment and aspirations seriously when they're grappling with the immediacy of survival at 18 years old? So if you're able to, from their 14, support their aspirations alongside the reality of leaving care, and there's more of a balance between the two, I think that's a really good thing. Like, I never had social workers talking to me about work experience or what I wanted to do post 18. Now, whilst the last thing I'll say, whilst I had the social worker take me to the open day, when I got into Cambridge, my local authority told me either you go to Cambridge and you forfeit your right to a council flat in London, or you stay in London and keep the council flat. I was told that if I went to Cambridge, I would lose my accommodation. And I know that happens to many kids now. And so I think there's a lot to be done around how we nurture aspiration, how we fund it, and how we make sure that the looming reality of leaving care doesn't stifle the potential of a young person.
Can I just come in there as well, yeah. Ashley? That's really, I mean, in terms of the 25 age, but there's something called supported lodgings, and it's a provision that's really underutilized, and we feel very, very passionately is at least another possible option for particularly teenagers so that they don't hit that care cliff at 18 and can still be part of a family. And I was a supported lodgings host for a number of years, and in effect cared for teenagers from the ages of 16 all the way up to 23. And that's another way that we can open up our heart and our homes to be able to actually support young people into education and with all the life skills that's necessary. So for any budget holders out there, and if you don't know about supported lodgings, please come and speak to us at the end, because it's something that we're finding incredible individuals, couples and families to step forward to do, which is a one way that we can continue to add to the solution. And, right, oh, there was another gentleman you pointed out.
In lots of local authorities, it's called Shared Lives, and just like foster parents, there's a huge gap and it's funded. So please, please sign up and ask for it, because like you said, it's such a desperate need and such a great stepping stone.
Wonderful, thank you.
Thank you.
And there was
Ashley, where were you sending me?
It's only because I've seen him from the start, bless him.
And we'll
he looks a bit like Lyndon. Excuse my bias.
Oh, Lyndon, I'm sure your name's
Lyndon. If only I was as nice as Lyndon, eh? Yeah, hi, Ashley. My name's Dave. And I was fostered as a child when I was up until the age of 5.
Yeah.
But it was kept a secret from me, so I didn't actually know about it. And I found out when I was 30 that it actually happened.
Who did you think they were?
I came over from Nigeria during the Biafra War. So
were you farmed? Was it farming?
No, it wasn't okay. Farmed. It was in family. But I didn't find out. I just used to have these memories of going to this house on a hill in New Haven, which is in the South Coast, and a vague memory of another place. And I used to ask my mum, because I was reunited with my birth mother eventually, and I used to ask her, where was this place I used to go to on a hill that I remembered? And the story was that I went to a nursery, and that was what she said it was. So I had these vague memories, because she was basically, my mum was white, and she was ashamed of, Yeah, she was basically, not she wasn't, but there was a lot of stigma attached to, you know, having a child and everything. So I was put into foster care. She couldn't care for me. My father did what many fathers do and buggered off. And that was my story. But so I didn't know till I was 30, and it came out during a family when there was some troubles with my brother. But my question was, that's enough about me. My question was about you. One of the things that stayed with me, despite being reunited with my mum, is, and she was even struggled emotionally to sort of parent me when we were reunited, was I found that you have to kind of parent yourself as a...
I never graduate from these things. Like, I never... Like, I do all these events, but when you hear a story, my God, it's so moving. Yeah. Is that how you feel?
Yeah. I'm just wondering whether that's an experience that you understood in a sense, because there was always a sense of a loss of... Oh. And I don't mind people... I'm 59 years old now, and it's stayed with me even now. It doesn't go away. And I've been around lots of people, and I've got my own children, I've got grandchildren. But the child within me still feels very much... It's quite emotional. I'm really sorry about this.
Let's make him feel comfortable, man. That's all good. You're doing great.
Yeah, my question was just about whether you feel that you have to parent yourself in the absence of parents, either being there physically or emotionally because of the absence of your birth parents.
Wow, man. Is it David?
David, yeah.
David, bless you, my friend. And well done for just being so open. I mean, wow. Wow. Do you know what? I feel like I want to say, come to me when I'm your age, and then because I've got a 2 and a 4 year old, and I've been married for 7 years, and And as I said earlier, I have had to do a lot of work just to get to a point of being able to like to feel like I'm capable as a father and just as a lover and as, do you know what I mean? Like when you've not had consistent love, you will relate to what I'm saying. You feel the fear of whether you've got it in you to give it. And so, and I don't think you know, speaking about me, I don't think I will ever graduate from the wounds of that. I don't think you ever do. Early years are so critical, and those attachments and those bonds that you form serve you for the rest of your life. Like, again, I'm not a scientist, but I know enough to know that. And so lacking that, you're always going to feel it on some level. And you learn, you grow, you do the work. But I still have days where I look at my kids and I'm like, wow, this is real. Like, I'm like, this is real. Like, we're doing it and it's great. And I love them and they love me and all of that. But, I do feel that for me, it's my faith. Some will call it the universe. Some will call it whatever. I'm not precious about how people articulate that. But I do feel love. Do you know what I mean? Like I feel like I'm loved. And there was, regardless of all that I've just banged on about, I've always felt, and I think we all have the capacity to tap into it. And that's not to dismiss the reality of our wounds, but I think that there's goodness out there that edges you forward. And maybe I'm just an optimist, I don't know. But I've had that force in my life and that has served me well. And at times where I feel like I'm lacking, be it to be a good dad or to even just get up, David, and do what I need to do, I try and tap into that. And we all have our ways of doing that. And I know I'm being a bit nebulous and unclear, but what I'm trying to say is that it's within you to love people and it's within you to live your best life. However you tap into that. Does that make sense? I hope it does. Yeah.
You clear to go for another question? I just know that we are really stretching out.
I just want to chat to Dave over there.
I just like to say.
Yeah, let's. No,
we
we're good.
One more.
We're good.
Because
we're good.
You
yeah.
are giving of yourself yes. deeply. Yes. And so maybe if we go for one more question yeah. and then we will allow Ashley to go for a well-earned book signing and beer. Huh?
Yes.
Hi.
But I'd love to hear your story. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Hi, I'm Ada. I'm really lucky to have grown up in a family where my parents are foster carers. I'm here.
Hello,
hey,
sorry.
It's all right. And thank you so much for sharing your story, particularly around being in residential homes. One of the children that my parents looked after, my parents had to make a really painful decision to stop looking after him, and he's now in his second home. And it's amazing to hear about Lyndon, who went above and beyond, it sounds like, the scope of his work. I just wondered, from a structural point of view and how those organisations run these residential homes, have you got any thoughts about how we can improve them so that you didn't move from so many?
That really shouldn't have been the last question.
Sorry.
my god, the other thing that I'm forgetting very quickly, because it's a Saturday evening, that I'm bound to BBC impartiality rules that I'm probably failing at right now. Oh my god, so what's your name again? Ada. We know there's profiteering in residential care homes. We know that, like, often these are private companies running children's homes. I'm so sorry if you work for a children's home, because there are good ones. But private companies make a lot of money off children's homes. How it works is that there could be a certain care order. That child is then, they need to be in a home. The local authority doesn't have accommodation. So they find a home and they're like, how much do you want for the kid? And there is rampant profiteering in these homes. That model, it's not controversial for me to say there's cross-sector agreement that model needs to change quickly, because kids like me become very financially lucrative. So that's the first thing. A lot of the workers, there are good workers like Lyndon that I've touched on, but a lot of care home workers are very poorly trained. The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, I interviewed her not too long ago about on children's homes. And she said that she, not me, she has said that these workers are like security workers. In other words, former bouncers not professionally trained, right? The therapeutic and trauma-informed experience that you need with a vulnerable young person should be paramount. And in a lot of these homes, the workers don't have those insights. So that needs to change. The training that these workers are given. I'm just going to leave it at there. I'm going to leave it at those 2 points, but there's a lot. And can I just, in fact, and I'm not just plugging my work. I did, have you heard of File on 4 on Radio 4? I did a big audio documentary about children under deprivation of liberty orders who are sent to these care homes. It's called, if you want to listen to it, because it's about your question, it is called, can you Google my name and File on 4 and it will come up? I'm tired. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're going to call it a night there with Ashley. Ashley, thank you, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.